The Bible reading this morning is from 2 Kings chapter 2, verses 1 through 12. And if you'd like to follow in the Pew Bible, that's on page 352. Now, when the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven by a whirlwind, Elijah and Elisha were on their way to Gilgal. Elijah said to Elisha, "Stay here, for the Lord has sent me as far as Bethel." But Elisha said, "As the Lord lives, and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." So they went down to Bethel. The company of prophets who were in Bethel came out to Elisha and said to him, "Do you know that today the Lord will take your master away from you?" And he said, "Yes, I know. Keep silent." Elijah said to him, "Elisha, stay here, for the Lord has sent me to Jericho." But he said, "As the Lord lives, and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." So they came to Jericho. The company of prophets who were at Jericho drew near to Elisha and said to him, "Do you know that today the Lord will take your master away from you?" And he answered, "Yes, I know. Be silent." Then Elijah said to him, "Stay here, for the Lord has sent me to the Jordan." But he said, "As the Lord lives, and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." So the two of them went on. 50 men of the company of prophets also went and stood at some distance from them, as they both were standing by the Jordan. Then Elijah took up his mantle and rolled it up and struck the water. The water was parted to the one side and to the other, until the two of them crossed on dry land. When they had crossed, Elijah said to Elisha, "Tell me what I may do for you before I am taken from you." Elisha said, "Please let me inherit a double share of your spirit." He responded, "You have asked a hard thing. Yet, if you see me as I am being taken from you, it will be granted you. If not, it will not." As they continued walking and talking, a chariot of fire and horses of fire separated the two of them, and Elijah ascended in a whirlwind into heaven. Elisha kept watching and crying out, "Father, Father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen." But when he could no longer see him, he grasped his own clothes and tore them in two pieces.
I'll invite the young people to join me up front if you like. Thank you. Hi, Emma. It's nice to have you back. Hello. Thank you for that, everybody. I don't know what to say. I don't know. I've been working on this children's sermon for a couple days now. I don't have much. Sometimes they're easy, and sometimes I kind of struggle with them a little bit. But you are always asking me the exact question that I'm going to have to otherwise just tee up myself. Like, we got to take this show on the road because you're just perfect. How do I come up with them? I ask Pastor Rick what he's going to preach on, what the scripture is, what he's thinking about. He's usually thinking about chocolate. And I can't talk about chocolate. We could, couldn't we? We should just eat chocolate up here every Sunday. That'd be pretty good, wouldn't it? And then I try to start just thinking about what I might share with you all that is connected to what Pastor Rick is going to preach about. And you know why we try to make this moment tied into what Pastor Rick is going to preach about, even though you all aren't going to be in here probably when he's preaching? And that is because we want to share our spiritual journey with you because you're such an important part of this congregation. And so we want to talk here about the same thing that we'll talk about in the big sermon so that we can kind of all be on the same page, all be thinking the same thing, because we want to enjoy our connection with you all in that way. And sometimes when I don't quite know what I'm going to say, like, everything becomes a metaphor. Like, everything I do, I'm like eating a donut and I'm thinking, oh, I could talk about donuts. Not much to say about donuts. Or somebody, I'd be driving in traffic and somebody will cut me off and I'll think, oh, maybe I can talk about that. And what I've realized is that preparing for the children's sermon or for the young people's sermon, not the children's sermon, helps me be mindful. And so I'm really grateful that you all teach me to be mindful as I prepare for this moment with you. Because I have to kind of think, what's happening in my life? What experiences do I have that are inspirational or meaningful or offer me the chance to learn something that I might share with you? And I think that's really a lot about, you know, people talk about mindfulness. It's something that it's all over kind of literature and culture right now. There's a lot of people talking about mindfulness. And I think in some ways, being mindful is just paying attention. Attention to the moment that you're in. Close attention, that's right. There's a very wise teacher named Thich Nhat Hanh, and he talks about mindfulness a lot. And one of his sayings is, when you're washing the dishes, you should only be washing the dishes. And what he means by that is that our minds just tend to always, you know, you all are some really smart people. And one of the gifts of being a smart person is that you have such amazing ideas to share. One of the challenges about being a smart person is that sometimes it's hard to just get your mind to be a little more quiet. So when you're washing the dishes, you're thinking, oh, did I get that report done for school? What am I, have I bought my Valentine's Day cards? That's exactly right. It could be a metaphor for other things as well, those lessons that are coming to us. And sometimes when you're washing the dishes or doing whatever, if you can just focus on the act that you are doing in that moment, it clears a space for those other ideas to come to us. And so we want to be on that journey with you, and that's why we try to talk in this moment about what we're talking about in church in general, because you're an important part of that space. And Lent, we're starting Lent on Wednesday, and that's the time that leads up to Easter. And some people think of Lent as a time to give something up. Like they might give up chocolate or they might give up coffee. And that's, if that helps you be centered, that's a nice approach. But others of us, those of us who are not strong enough to give up anything, we think about, well, maybe I could clear some space in my life, some space for God to be more present, some space for me to be more present, even just some space for me to be quiet with myself. And so I thank you all for helping me clear a space to be quiet with myself, and I thank you all for being part of this journey with us. We're really glad to have you as company. Will you join me in prayer? Gracious God, we are so thankful for our relationships with each other, for what we teach each other, for what we learn from each other, and for the support and love and kindness that we show together moment by moment, holding a hand, holding a door open, giving a smile, sharing a sermon. Thank you for our time together and for your constant presence in it. These things we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
Sharon Everly, I already mentioned our time that we spent last Sunday at Michael Lewis's home in Silver Lake. And meeting Eva, who we've heard about occasionally over these past couple of years. Eva is going to be 93, and we were all looking forward to meeting her. And there were about 20 people from this church who made that trek from here out to Silver Lake. And we realized the distance that Michael has to come every Sunday when he comes here. Very thankful for him. And Eva is a delight. She was everything that Michael said and more. She's almost 93, and really, seriously, she could be a stand-up comedian. I mean, she is that sharp. You know, I just really admire her. She lost about 75 members of her family in the Holocaust. She lived in Budapest during her growing up years, and later came to this country, and of course has been here for many, many years. And the question that was kind of behind all of our minds was, how do you go on in life when you have lost so much? And she is so full of joy, and she discovered opera when she came to this country, and that became a joy in her life. And so she often goes to opera, and it's a big part of her life. And we realized that she and Michael have a very special relationship. She's almost like your grandmother. She's the grandmother I wish I had. And of course, Michael is very important to her because I think they talk to each other about every 3 days, and they've got a very, very good relationship, which is unique. I don't have quite that kind of. I don't think anybody has quite that kind of a relationship. And so I was thinking about her when I was looking at the text that was assigned for this morning, and that is how do we pass things on from one generation to the next, and that's what the story is all about. It's a very odd story. It's about two people, Elijah and Elisha. The two names are so close that I thought that after Dave and Jack's little thing, that we should just call them Dave and Jack instead of Elijah and Elisha. That would at least distinguish them as two different people. And it's a very odd little story. I don't know if you followed along in the text or not, or heard the words. But it is so odd that we wonder, well, what's the relevance for us? I've often spoken about how the text often is an instrument of transformation for us. That is, if we dig deeply into many of these texts in the Bible, we find ourselves transformed by dealing with them. And of course, I'm constantly in a relationship with one text or another most of my life, and I have been formed over the years by these wonderful stories. And I think they're almost like the DNA of life. And I think that's where the level of this story really speaks to us, is at a much deeper level. And Dave did a great job reading it today and didn't get mixed up about the two names. I think I'm going to, he was a little worried about it, but I'm going to pronounce them differently. I'm going to just say Elisha and Elijah, right? That'll work to distinguish the two. Just taking a step back and looking at the general context of where this text sits in the story, the Bible has what looks like a lot of history in it. We have, for example, 1 and 2 Samuel that deals with the prophet Samuel and the rise of David as the king and the rise of the nation, actually, of Israel, and the way that David kind of formed Israel as we have learned about it in the Christian church. And before that, of course, there were the judges. There's a book dedicated to the judges. And before that, of course, there was Moses. And so this problem of leadership goes all the way back to the origin of the Jewish history. And, of course, that history then becomes Christian history as we look at it. After 1 and 2 Samuel, the story of King David, of course, we get King Solomon. And that is really the glory days of Israel. That's at its apex. And it never regained those golden years ever again. In fact, there were golden years, which means that they might not have really been so great in the actual living of them. And then we've got these two books called 1 and 2 Kings. 1 Kings begins with the Solomon story and then eventually his death. And then in 1 and 2 Kings, you get this sort of narrative of one king after another. And by the time you get to the end of 2 Kings, it's just sort of almost like a funeral dirge. You know, one king lived, and then he died. And then another king lived, and then he died. And there's a sort of a rhythmic point that the history makes, and that is that there is the succession of things. And one of my favorite sayings I looked up this morning. This was actually attributed to Arnold Toynbee, who was a historian, who claimed that historians say that history is one damn thing after another. And that's always been kind of a, I don't know, I'm not one for four-letter words, but I think sometimes that they're very, very important to use properly. And I think it using that word in that context kind of points to the fact that there is this repetitiveness about history, that it kind of recapitulates human issues over and over and over again. And so when we realize that the telling of the history of the Jewish people is not really a neutral telling of the facts as they were, even though there are a lot of facts and dates in this text. But it makes us think about telling our own history. I knew growing up in the age that I did in the late 50s and early 60s, I would hear about our presidents and, you know, the history of this country. And I realize now, looking back, that there was a lot of embellishment about our presidents and a lot of the history that we kind of, you know, look back on as the golden age, you know, when the Constitution was created and these amazing people who created it and the Declaration of Independence and all of that history, we realize that there is no neutral position from which we can look at life and evaluate it. One thing I kept hearing during George Bush's presidency is that all the troubles that he went through, he kept deferring and say, well, we'll let history be the judge. And I heard that over and over and over again. And that's true. I think history will judge it, but that also makes the point that history is a value judgment. History is often told by the winners and not the losers. And history always has its partisan edge to it. It tries to remember or misremember the past in such a way. Brian Williams was one of my favorite newscasters, and he got into trouble for doing what most of us do, and that is embellishing. I felt really bad for him, that he felt the need to embellish it, and then it kind of intruded on his professional role that he plays in the news industry. But then it casts a light on the whole media and how they shape and form our perception of the way that things are going on now. And we realize that there is no neutral place from which we can make judgments about what is going on now. And so we realize that in kind of lifting Brian Williams up as a failure of the media to actually focus on things that are really important that are going on in this life, it really brings to light how we bring our values to how we see life. And so we kind of bring that now to these texts. And we're not all that different from the way this history is told, because it gets changed over and over and over again. I'm not sure how many biographies of Abraham Lincoln have been written over the years. Maybe you might know, Bill, but a lot of them. And they all have their own perspectives, and they all have... And then on the TV the other night, there was an ad for a program coming on television, you know, searching for the historical Jesus. And I thought, oh my God, you're not going to find much, because all we have is in the Gospels, and the Gospels have a particular point of view that they are trying to get across. So they form their story about Jesus to express that point of view. And so we realize that we're kind of in a shifting pattern of values when we look at life, the life that we live, the way that we tell our own stories. We will often tell our stories depending on what kind of role we want to play. So the story from 2 Kings kind of reminded me of my father. I talked about him, I think it was last week, talking about mentors and When my father died and then my mother died, I realized, I think at the age of 57, that I was finally an adult. I felt, you know, I don't know, maybe you had that experience that, you know, well, now I'm it. You know, I'm the one, you know, in the next generation that's supposed to take responsibility now for my life and myself, because I don't have my parents around. Because as long as my parents were around, I thought that, you know, I was still their son, meaning that they had the power and the authority. And so the problem then of passing, or actually I should say, the problem of receiving the authority to live your own life is a problem. And this is what the text addresses. Now, if you heard the pattern as David read the text, you might notice that there's a pattern of three, which often happens in these stories. And it's Elisha and Elijah who are going. It's sort of the transition point. Elisha has been the disciple of Elijah. Now, in the Bible, prophets are very, very important. They are the ones who are the kingmakers. King David was a king only because Yahweh told Samuel to anoint him as king. And so Elisha was very important in 1 Kings. He was the kingmaker, a very, very important person. And now here at the very first verse of chapter 2, we know what the story is going to be about. And it says, now when Yahweh was about to take Elijah up to heaven by a whirlwind, Elijah and Elisha were on their way from Gilgal. So we know that this is a point where the transfer of power is going to happen. And if you look at a map, Elijah says, well, the Lord has called me to this place. And with the implication to Elisha to stay behind. And of course, Elisha says, no, I'm going to go with you. And that happens three times. And each time when they leave a city, the prophets there are saying, don't you know that the Lord or Yahweh is going to take your master? And Elisha says, yes, I know that. And so that happens three times. And there is the awareness that this transfer of power has to be handled very, very delicately. I'm always amazed after a presidential election that on, January 20th, when the oath of office is taken by the new president, how smoothly it seems to go from the previous president to the next president. I think historically, we kind of get a little numb to how amazing that is. Because the transfer of power in the history has usually been through violence. And so we have been able to manage that in a way that does not create violence, which I think is a great achievement of Western democracy. So the transfer of power is very, very important. So if you look at a map, and those three times that Elijah wants to shake off Elisha, it's just meandering, you know. They just end up pretty much at the same place where they started. So it's not really a journey, but it's a process. Now, they're not actually going anywhere, but they're going to be transformed by where they're going. And so, on the third time, of course, they arrive at the River Jordan, and Elijah takes his mantle, which is his sort of cape, which, by the way, is the symbol of his power. And he rolls it up and he taps it on the water of the Jordan River. And, of course, it stops and parts, and they are able to walk across it to the other side. And, of course, if you're looking at it historically, you're going to get all in a bunch because, you know, water doesn't behave that way, nor does God. Nor does anything we know in this world. And so we know that we are on metaphorical territory here. It's kind of like a reminder of the people of Israel passing through the Red Sea in a similar circumstance. And before they go across the river, though, Elijah asks Elisha, well, what, what do you want me to do for you? And Elisha says, give me double the power that you have, which seems like a little greedy to us, but it is actually the claim of the firstborn son to have a double portion. So it's part of the transference of power that's going to happen. And he said, and then Elijah says, well, you know, that's hard for me to grant, but if you witness, or if you are able to see me taken up, then, of course, that power will come to you. They go across the River Jordan. They arrive on the other side, and almost immediately, a chariot of fire with horses comes, and the way the story is written, that sort of vision comes between Elijah and Elisha, and it separates them. And then, as the story goes, you know, we've been kind of taught incorrectly that Elijah was taken up into heaven in a chariot. Actually, he's taken up into the heavens in the whirlwind, kind of sucked up, you might say. And again, you know, scientifically, things don't work that way. But metaphorically, this is very powerful stuff. What happens in this scene is that by being taken up in the whirlwind of God, Elijah's life was validated by God. He was a true prophet. And so he comes to a point then at the end of the text where Elisha is watching and cries out, Father, Father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen, is actually a name that he is applying to Elijah, meaning you are the chariots of Israel and its horsemen. That is, you are the one who has protected Israel. And a little bit later on in 2 Kings, that same term is going to be applied to Elisha when he dies. He is going to be called the chariots of God and God's horsemen. So once that scene happens, Elisha, of course, tears his garments in half, which is a sign of deep grief and mourning. And so he leaves his clothes behind, and he picks up Elijah's mantle. And, of course, that's a symbolic act of putting on the authority and the power that Elijah had. So he gets back to the Jordan River, taps on the river with the mantle of Elijah, and Elisha then goes across and goes to actually 50 prophets. I guess that was a profession back then, like it is now, I guess. Who witnessed the whole thing. And the part that doesn't get read in the text this morning is that these 50 prophets, having witnessed Elijah taken up, they're bothered by that, and they want to go looking for him. They think that, well, you know, if he got sucked up, maybe God brought him somewhere else and dropped him down. And Elisha says there's no need to go look for him. And they persisted. And so he lets them do what they need to do. And, of course, they search every valley and high and low. And they come back in 3 days. And they say, we can't find him. And Elisha says, I told you so. Now, this Sunday is Transfiguration Sunday, which is another word for transformation. This is Transformation Sunday. Usually the text that gets read on this Sunday is the text from Mark, the Gospel of Mark, chapter 9, where Jesus with his disciples goes up on top of the mountain and is transformed before their very eyes. And he is so white and bright that they could hardly look at him. And the disciples are a little freaked out about this. I mean, who wouldn't be? And they, you know, in their sort of confusion, their nervous confusion, they say stupid things. And, well, you know, let's build a couple of places to worship here for you. And along with them, you notice, was Moses and Elijah. were there with Jesus and his disciples, and they say, well, let's make a little altar for all three of you, they say, Moses, Elijah, and Jesus. And then, of course, out of the heavens, you know, this is my son. That's when Jesus' life is validated. And so it goes. And one of the issues that I think this text bears down hard on is the issue that we struggle with every day, and that is the legitimacy and the authority of people in power. And that is an issue that is never solved. We sometimes get good leaders, sometimes we get bad leaders, and sometimes leaders are good for us, and sometimes they're very destructive. And the issue is, where do these leaders get their authority and their legitimacy? And I commented on the oath of office that is taken here in this country of the new president. That's where they get their legitimacy, is through the political process that they all go through to get to that point where they could raise their right hand, put their hand on the Bible, and swear the oath of office to protect the Constitution of the United States of America and to be its leader. Now, authority is a whole other thing. Authority is conferred. That was always an issue in the Bible. People would come into power who claimed that they had the authority to be the leader, and they did not. And, of course, the people who pointed them out as not having the authority of God were the prophets. And there were good prophets and bad prophets. There were prophets who would, you know, just sort of say nice things about the leader just to get into their good graces. And then there were these other prophets who were sort of these swarthy men from the desert. And if you look and see how 2 Kings describes Elijah, it's almost like describing John the Baptist. The sort of hard as nails person who speaks strictly on behalf of Yahweh and nobody else. He cannot be bought by any special interest group. He cannot be persuaded by popularity. These prophets were people who called the authorities to task on behalf of Yahweh and also on behalf of justice. And that justice was always the measure that was used to evaluate whether some leader had authority or not. And so that's the issue that we deal with every 4 years, every 2 years. We still go through the same thing, and so it goes. Now, on a personal level, I think this is also a text not only for us as a group, but also us as individuals, and that is where do we get our sense of legitimacy and our sense of authority in our own lives? And that's really where we do get into trouble, because often we don't want that authority. Or we might want that authority, but to use it in destructive ways. And that's why I mentioned my father early on. It's not that he necessarily taught me anything that, you know, that really, you know, stands in my mind, but he was the authority in my life, all my life, both my father and my mother. And it's really devastating to lose that authority, because then that kind of leaves you naked, so to speak, to your own life. And to accept that mantle of being responsible for your own life is probably one of the most important points in anybody's life, because not everybody accepts that mantle. When you have accepted that mantle, when you speak from that authentic place from within yourself, you will know that. Nobody's going to point it out to you. Nobody is going to tell you whether you have it or not. They might try. but only you know. Have you taken those steps? And it's not just one step. This is a process. That's why this sort of meandering journey that the two take, it's not a journey that we're on necessarily, although, you know, that metaphor works in a different sense. But this sort of circling around, we might say, and Elisha following Elijah around, trying to get into a position where he is in a place where he can actually witness his master leaving the stage. And so picking up that mantle, putting that mantle of authority on, I think psychologically means that you become a fully responsible adult for your own life. Now, that's a problem in religion as we practice it in this country, because people still want somebody else to take that mantle of authority, whether it be a pastor that they follow or some kind of teaching. I think Jesus can be misused in that way as putting on this mantle of authority and just being kind of a puppet for what they think Jesus said and did. But we can see Jesus taking on that mantle of authority in his own life and where that led him. It's difficult to do, to be responsible for your own life. But it's like a relay race. We go around and around, and we have the baton for a certain period of life. And then here comes that baton as we're waiting for our turn, and it gets passed on to us. It's held out, and it's our choice, you know, are we going to take it or not? And another choice is, are we going to drop it? It can be bungled at that point, too. So here we are. We are at our place in history. We are at our place in our own lives. We've got this funny little story, and many stories like it, about how difficult it is to pass that baton from one generation to the next and to take it and to run with it. And I don't mean to crawl with it. That's why the Apostle Paul talked about his own life in terms of the race. You know, he ran the good race. He fought the good fight. He did his part. So just thinking about our own lives, I don't know where you are in your own life. We're all at different places in life. But we're in that process of either having the baton, ready to hand it off, or we're standing there ready to take it. Or we're standing somewhere else trying to avoid the whole thing, which is where most people are. And a lot of churches allow you to be in that other place. So for us to think about, before the whirlwind comes and takes us off stage, running the good race is very, very important. Fighting the good fight is very important. And we kind of talked about that last Sunday. Knowing when the right time comes and doing the right thing. It's kind of, we come back to some of these really basic things about life. And just leaving you with a thought today, the image, the metaphor of the relay race and taking on that mantle of authority for your own life and speaking from that place of power within your own self, which really does bring not only power, but it brings peace, an odd kind of peace. And that's the peace that Jesus said the Spirit would leave behind, not the kind of peace the world has, but the kind of peace that the Spirit brings. And by taking on the mantle, by taking on your own authority, is actually inviting the Spirit to be in your life. And that's where our power is with the Spirit of God. And so may we run hard, may we run fast, and may we run with passion.
Will you join me in prayer? We say we want to encounter you, God, to align ourselves with your will on earth, to know your ways. But what does that mean? Does it only happen in this hour? Does it only happen at deeply important times when we're thinking about it, or only if we receive wisdom twice that of those who teach us? How do we become agents of your will when the mundane takes so much time to manage and navigate, and when so many of the questions seem unimportant, at least at first? But God, who is in all things, we know that you are always at work in our lives, in the big moments and the small moments, in our going up and our coming down, in the way we move through the world, run the race, perceive those around us, and interact with the rest of your holy creation. You are there, offering choices and options and insight, calling us to introspection and patience, to first know ourselves and our place in your divine dream. Gracious God, you send teachers and prophets into our lives to join us in the spaces from which our identities emerge. You call us to be guides and teachers and prophets for others as well. In this cycle of teaching, we are reminded that life is not linear. Simultaneously, we are each teacher and student. Our good and the common good are not either or. In you, there is plenty. Living water for those who will never thirst again, and daily bread to sustain and nourish our mission. Together on this journey, we pray as Jesus taught his disciples to pray, saying, "Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil, for thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever and ever. Amen."